Welcome back to Taboo. My name's Katrina, your host today. I am joined by two special guests. Nick, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, Nick Russell, sales director, back again.
And Mike, could I ask you to introduce yourself, please?
Yes, I'm Michael Rabin of Compton. I'm one of the co-founders of the business.
And today we're going to be talking about commercial real estate. But before I start, can you just give us a little intro to Compton and what you guys do?
Yes, so Compton is a commercial property agency. We specialise in leasing and capital transaction advice for landlord and investor clients and occupiers.
Perfect. Our very well-educated expert for today, hopefully.
I guess that's why I'm here.
If we kick things off with question number one, which is quite simply, what is commercial real estate?
What is commercial real estate? Commercial real estate is, I guess, anything that's not residential. So properties such as offices and factories and warehouses and, you know, restaurants, cafes, retail, hospitals, anything that is, you know, a building that is not residential, arguably. Yeah, so that would be commercial.
Does it have to be a building?
Not necessarily, but that's usually what happens with property.
Yeah, true. I guess, can you live in a commercial property?
Well, can you live in a commercial property? Well, not strictly, well, not lawfully. You know, we have planning laws in this country, so those that abide by them, you shouldn't actually live in a commercial property because it has certain restrictions. I would say that if you are thinking of, you know, converting a property from, you know, a commercial property to a residential one, you have to kind of follow a set of guidelines and legislation. And that's usually done by a planning application to convert it from one use to another. And the commercial property use class currently is what's known as E, which covers a wide variety of commercial uses. And, you know, in order to, you know, convert it from an E to a C3 residential use, you have to go through a planning application, which sometimes can be quite rigorous. But more recently, they have relaxed some of the planning laws in some parts of London, which allow you to kind of bypass the need for a planning application through, you know, permitted development rights, which you can just, you know, you abide by, you tick a few boxes, you're making sure you're compliant, and then effectively you can change that lawfully in doing so.
Yeah, it's supposed to be quick, isn't it? 56 days, as long as you tick all the sort of three main boxes, then
yes,
you can get it in 56 days, which... Oh. Try and do a planning application in 56 days. Good luck with that.
No, that's certainly not the case. But yeah, there's lots of criteria to follow.
What about live work units?
Well, I don't necessarily think that they exist as much anymore. It used to be a thing. It almost. I don't even know if it actually had an actual planning use.
Right.
But you know, they were a thing, you know, within the past kind of 20, 30 years. And then I don't think that you can obtain a live, did you say live work?
Yeah, live work.
So that doesn't really exist anymore.
Okay.
I think if people had managed to obtain a live work, then obviously that will continue. But I don't think that there's a way of getting that now.
Also probably difficult to mortgage as well.
Well, yes, but I think it was almost the case that, you know, it was actually a residential dwelling. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember in the old days it was just, you know, you'd valued it if it was an apartment. You'd value it as an apartment basis, yeah, but you have the lawful ability to work from it. But obviously now with modern day, you know, working from home practices,
same thing really.
It's a little different. Yeah. I think as long as people are not effectively using a residential property for means of lots of, you know, transient people coming in, visiting, having meetings, doing effectively work, and then no one actually living and sleeping you know, there,
yep,
then that kind of becomes more strictly an office. Okay. But there's nuances there, I'm sure.
Yeah.
What about when you start getting developments and stuff where it's got mixed use with commercial on the bottom, resi on top?
Yes.
What's that classified as?
Just a mixed use property development. But you're right. They normally are nicely compartmentalised, you know, between, okay, the bottom portion is commercial and the top half is residential. So in a modern development, it normally has, you know, independent, you know, communal cores, you know, lifts, stairways, things like that. They don't normally cross over in the strictest sense. So the planners like to have them segregated. Well, the property developers do too, and I'm sure the occupants are as well. But there are in some instances some older methods where, you know, sometimes there's shared entrances and shared, you know, facilities and things like that. So that's probably not allowed in the modern day because they like to keep them kind of segregated.
I guess it makes a bit more sense, doesn't it? Great. Any other questions on commercial real estate?
No, I'm sure
just
we'll get into it as we go.
Just the next four.
Yeah, sure.
Moving on to question number two.
Sure.
What is the role of a commercial agent?
Ah, well, the role of a commercial agent is acting as a property advisor and an expert for their clients. So if you've got a client that is, you know, seeking to acquire a commercial property, or you've got a landlord that's looking to, you know, lease out a commercial property, then I guess the commercial agent is acting as advisor for that particular party. So from advising on, you know, refurbishments and how best to kind of package a property and obviously then market a property, you provide various strategic advice, and then the idea is obviously that you hopefully can you know, garner inquiries and things like that from, you know, tenants and occupiers alike, and then take that through to advising on the transaction, which sometimes can be quite complex, all the way through to completing the deal, essentially. But, you know, it can work from both sides of the fence. You can also have commercial agents that can act and represent occupiers. It's not always strictly just landlords that have the benefit of using commercial agents. You certainly can have occupiers that would benefit of having some commercial property advice. So you could have, say, for example, an advertising agency. You know, they want to acquire 10,000 square feet or something like that, and they don't. You know, they work in advertising. They don't work in property, so they would need to have somebody, you know, provide them with some guidance and advice to ensure that they can, you know, be have a process that's very well managed, and take them through all the way through to acquiring the property and looking after their best interests effectively. So it can work in both sides.
And do you help with the design of that space, advise in what?
Yeah, we can do, yeah.
Yeah, no. So if you go into that finer detail, subject to, the, I suppose, the advice that they want?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that kind of, you know, sets, well, but certainly, you know, my company apart, you know, we do like to kind of get involved with that side of the transaction because we know it's going to be of benefit and we care. You know, we actually care about, you know, what kind of properties that we are introducing to our clients, you know, from an occupational standpoint, that is. You know, we want to make sure that it's conducive to, you know, what their brief is, you know, and, you know, it needs to work. There's no good putting, you know, trying to usher them into a property that perhaps, you know, later down the line doesn't suit their needs. Mm-hmm. You know, no one's going to thank you for that. We'd like to think that, you know, we're very considerate to what the client actually, you know, requires.
Well, as they grow, you want them to come back, right?
Well, 100%. You know, we're all about repeat business, aren't we? It's not just about one deal. You want to build relationships. Mm-hmm. But we're obviously, we also, you know, similarly, when we do a lot of, you know, significantly, we do quite a lot of landlord work. So it's kind of similar situation because ultimately we want to have a property that we can successfully lease out for our client, and, you know, providing advice on, you know, design you know, configuration and things like that. That's
communal
just
space, all that sort of
well,
stuff.
Well, it's fundamentally important because, you know, ultimately we've got a let at the end of the day.
Yep.
And no one's, you know, the client's not going to thank us if we can't. So we always tend to like to get involved in a project from the inception stage of a project. And right the way through to, you know, marketing and identifying tenants for them. So, you know, we really enjoy that process as well. Get the most out of it.
What kind of are this? So it kind of starts at, well, who are your typical clients? You sort of mentioned landlords. Who are they?
we've got a whole variety of different clientele. Proud to say, you know, we deal with some of the best and most reputable landlords in the country, you know, from, you know, public property companies, you know, the likes of, Derwent London in particular, Helical, Threadneedle, you know, working with the Knights of Great Portland Estates. Those are some of the, you know, the bigger names that I'm just reeling off the tongue. And through to sort of private, you know, private property companies, mm-hmm. family offices, individuals, you know, it's a whole variety, really. We're quite versatile in that.
Mm. And what are the kind of steps to getting a commercial property then? If I was a family office and I wanted to move into a new office, buy a new office, where would I begin?
Where would you begin? Where would you begin in terms of like from starting the process?
From a process sort of thing. We need a new Nick. We're moving.
Yes.
Where do we begin?
Well, I'd like to think that you would give us a call and we'd arrange a meeting. We would sit down and go through, you know, what is the client brief? What is it that you're looking for? What stage are you at in your business? You know, how many members of staff are you now? But how many members of staff do you aspire to want to grow to within the next few years? Because ultimately, you need to make sure you've got a big enough boat to carry everybody. And then the questions will be asked. But how long will you need to move for? You know, is it a 1 year gig? Is it, you know, 5 years? Do you want something that's you know, quite traditional and corporate and, you know, simplistic, or do you want something that's quite unique and quirky and you know, it's more representative of your brand and something that's a bit edgier? You know, there's a whole kind of, you know, there's kind of almost like an endless kind of variety of different kind of pieces of criteria, and whether or not, you know, you know, there's different styles of property that you may want to consider. So there's also, you know, traditional occupation where you can just, you take a space, you sign a lease, it's an empty space, you fit it out yourself, mm-hmm. And you look after the property on your own. But then alternatively, there's a new school way of thinking more recently that, you know, landlords can also provide a space that's fully fitted, you know, it's fully furnished, everything's ready for you, and you don't have to necessarily find the capex to invest in space and occupy. And then there's also more of a full service.
Can I just, does that mitigate rent freeze for the landlord if they're providing everything for them?
Well, yes.
So you offset the rent freeze, saying, "Well, you don't need rent free because we're providing everything." Well, sort of a plug and play office.
Well, that's simplistic to think that one wouldn't want rent free or wouldn't need rent free. But you're absolutely right; it should mitigate against some of the overarching costs, because ultimately, what's a rent free period for? It's really the purpose of fitting out, arguably. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure that there's a proportion of the value of that rent free is maybe, you know, still an inducement to,
of course,
the financials of a
and
deal.
Maybe a longer term lease as well.
And that also plays its part. But yes, you're right. If something
and
is
that's
already...
where you guys come in as well, to negotiate the finer points of that.
Well, it is important because it's so highly nuanced, and it's important to, you know, be able to evaluate, you know, the state of a property, you know, and you know, as you quite rightly say, let's say a landlord did deliver a space that was brand new, fully fitted, fully furnished, everything bells and whistles,
and you're just plugging and playing.
You're plugging and playing, and you're probably like, "Well, why would you need to give a rent free?" But I think it's also, you know, you wouldn't have to give as much rent free, perhaps, as if it was completely open plan that required fitting out. So
I suppose also there's a lot of competitive spaces out there in certain areas of London that are all competing for similar clients, maybe. And they need to offer a competitive,
well,
compelling
do.
Reason why you're going to go to their building and not their other.
Well, 100%. But also, they want to protect their kind of, you know, headline contracted rent that they want to charge for income. So, you know, sometimes that can be the case, and it's kind of slightly compensated by a little bit of rent free that they can provide the occupier.
How long would rent free be in normal situations?
Well, it's a good question, and it's quite varied. So, you know, in some cases, you know, it kind of depends, and there's not strictly one answer to that. But I suppose if it was a traditional office where it's basically empty and it requires some fitting out and things like that, and I'd probably say if it was refurbished already in a Cat A state, then someone just needs to come in and fit out. Probably I would say they were taking a 5-year lease commitment, probably range anywhere between, you know, 9 to 12 months rent free, something like that.
Oh, wow.
Which is quite significant.
Yeah,
but you know, as you know, I suppose fit out costs are going up because construction costs are going up, you know, then that's going to put some pressure on levels of rent free, ultimately speaking, because, you know, it's a game of mathematics.
Ultimately, yeah. Sorry, just I want to backtrack for one second. So we talked about the role of a commercial agent, but I think we've covered off occupational agency. We just touch a little bit on investment agency, because I know that's the other side of your business as well.
Yes, sure.
Are you really?
Discussion three, Nick.
No, that's can you invest? It's a different question.
Continue.
What would you like to know from the investment side?
Just how does the role differ from an occupational agent, which we've kind of covered, to an investment agent where you are acting on the acquisition disposal side?
So, well, investment is a slightly different landscape, but it is kind of fundamentally important to understand, the occupational side of the business, because you need to appreciate what are the component parts of leasing in order to form your assumptions and opinion for an investment. Now, it's obvious, you know, some investments are long-term investments, and if the leases are, 15 to 20 years, you might be like, you know what? We ain't getting that back for a very, very long time. There's not much asset management to actually be done here. It's more simplistic. Whereas you might have a situation where you've got a multi-tenanted property, lots of different occupiers, lots of different lease events. There's lots of different activity. Some spaces are in better shape than others. So if we get this floor back, then obviously that needs to be refurbished. Then you need to make some assumptions as to, how long it might take, what level of rent you'll be able to charge in the future. So you know, it's not just about right. We're just going to value what the bricks are worth, in isolation. One will need to consider all the cash flow assumptions throughout. So it's a little bit more complicated. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit more science and predicting that needs to go on. But from an investment agent standpoint, he's got to understand all of those component parts really. To provide that kind of advice. Yeah. So that's obviously, what we do. And we do a lot of work for, like I mentioned to you, whether they're, big institutional clients or, private family offices and investors. We advise both on their investment
and
properties.
One thing we didn't touch on is I know you cover a big area, but you have a specialist area in London that you focus on. I don't think we've touched on that. Wanted to call you after this podcast where your sort of specialist area is.
No, we do.
Location wise.
No, we do, and that's right. No, we do have a focal point or a focus on what's described as the city fringe of London. It's kind of in a description that's not necessarily described as core. So, but over recent years, the city fringe has become quite desirable and attractive, and a lot of investment and money has gone into these locations. But areas such as Clerkenwell, Farringdon, Shoreditch, Old Street, Whitechapel, King's Cross, these locations
have seen huge change over in the last decade.
I've been in the game for nearly 25 years.
I wasn't
now.
Trying to, I said 10 years.
I flatter you and get you everywhere. But I've been in the game a little bit longer, and I'm proud to say that I've seen a lot of the change. In fact, I've been part of a lot of the change, actually, especially in the city fringe districts. It's been an amazing ride. You've got to remember that these locations in London, I mean, London's always been evolving for thousands of years, but, these old industrial parts of London, probably 30 years ago, I certainly went, when I started, 25 years ago, I used to be scared to walk down some of the streets. Yeah. Half the streets of Clerkenwell were either clapped out and, old warehouse buildings, were... had a rave the night before, or windows smashed in, graffiti all over the place, and I just remember thinking, goodness me, how am I going to lease this property, or how am I going to sell this property? It's such a dive or whatever.
Yep.
But I kind of learned to love it. But there was such an attraction from investors and occupiers that wanted something a bit edgier in an affordable part of town.
Yeah, which had potential to grow.
Masses of potential. But obviously, slowly, the cool occupiers moved in.
Especially the tech, right? With particularly Old Street and Shoreditch, those sort of areas.
Yeah, yeah. And, and also the creative businesses as well. Mm-hmm. Not strictly just tech, but those kind of occupiers kind of moved in, and they kind of made things cool. Mm-hmm.
The nightlife, probably changed the restaurants.
It did.
Everything.
It absolutely did. But then, even in the, when that kind of movement starts happening, then the institutions are, they behave a little bit more like sheep. You know, they then think, oh, we want to be where the cool kids hang out, you know, and then that's where the kind of the money then gravitates towards, you know, and that's how you have gentrification and things like that that happen. It doesn't happen overnight, but it happens over time. So, you know, it's been an awesome ride, you know, taking what would have been like a, I don't know, a former factory or, you know, warehouse property in Clerkenwell and, you know, renovating it, converting it from an old industrial building to more a commercial property offering, and you know, you have some really cool occupiers that you know dig those kind of architectural inspiring spaces, you know, certainly not traditional you know, glass and steel office blocks that you would probably see in more core locations perhaps. So it's been an awesome ride.
That's where do you cool. think's next?
What, in terms of district place. Or place?
Yeah, district.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so I kind of get asked that on a daily basis, and I wish I knew precisely. Where's next? Well, anywhere that's probably, you know, a location that I would say, locations that are obviously close to probably where the Elizabeth line seems to have propped up from. Yep. You know, over years, obviously, anyone in the industry would be talking about, you know, Crossrail, as the phrase has been coined for many years, but then since they christened it the Elizabeth line, you know, that's the go-to. That's the most, arguably the most connected and accessible of the lines, effectively, and that's what people want to gravitate towards because it allows a really incredible kind of east to west connection, and it's been amazing for us because, you know, my office is in Clerkenwell, is near Farringdon Station, and I can literally get in to, you know, Bond Street in the West End in 4 minutes flat. It's just
amazing.
It is an absolute dream. Obviously, all the platforms and the concourses and the trains, they're obviously amazing. But
the
to literally,
acoustics.
Yeah, it is. The whole thing is an incredible,
engineering,
phenomenal. But that has enabled people to access areas that they couldn't previously. But also where you have occupiers that perhaps were quite wedded to, say, the West End, and it's very hard to get into the West End because either there's not much space there or the rent's quite expensive. You can then access other areas because you can still come into the West End, like I said, within 4 minutes from Farringdon. It's unbelievable, or Heathrow and similar. And, you know, those areas have thrived, you know, like Farringdon in particular, as a consequence of the benefit of the added connectivity. And obviously, you know, landlord developers have obviously had the foresight many years earlier, because they can see that was always going to have a significant benefit when it arrived. So now it's arrived. It's started to, you know, crystallize that prediction.
Can I just ask a question? It's topic, but it's not one of these. I know particularly that Compton have championed the get back to the office movement.
It's not subtle.
Shall we say?
It's not subtle.
There's no subtlety there. I've seen Sean be a big champion of it. How have you seen London? How have you navigated and seen the changes when COVID hit, through COVID, and now we're sort of out of it, and well, whatever else is going on in the world that we don't really need to go into? But I'd be fascinated to see your first-hand view of all the changes.
Goodness me, very broad question.
It is a broad question,
and it's an amazing question. And we do talk about it every single day, and what's happened, what it means, where's it going. You know, the truth is that I think what we've discovered is that obviously the COVID era did accelerate something that perhaps was going to go in that similar kind of direction of, you know, remote working practices and things like that. But, you know, talking perhaps from a, you know, a non-biased perspective, obviously I sell office space, so I'm quite wedded to the need for office space. But speaking about it more impartially, from a business perspective, whatever line of business that you're in, you know, you want, it's incredibly important that people are together. People are, you know, with each other, because social interaction kind of breeds ideas, and ideas can be the success or failure of a business. And I think that people that literally take a stance that I only want to work from home, I don't want to see anybody, don't want to go into the office. Now, the problem is that they kind of restrict themselves from socializing with people. And then they have, you know, almost, you know, the same four walls every single day. And unfortunately, that doesn't necessarily breed great ideas and creativity.
I don't think it's good for them and anyone's mental health to look at the same four walls they live in.
No, all day. Well, I mean, I quite like the fact that I get up in the morning, I travel to the office. I meet my colleagues, friends, and clients, and do all sorts of things all day long. Immerse myself in the London landscape, and socialise and all that kind of stuff. And then you know what? At the end of the day, I travel back home, close the front door, disconnect, and then I'm in a different environment.
Your family. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's much healthier.
I agree.
I know some people might say, oh, it's incredibly inconvenient. It's a bit costly to travel and everything, but. I don't like the conflation between work and home life. And that's what we had when we were in, it was thrust upon us to be in lockdown.
Yep.
And I found it very difficult to be able to, differentiate between the two. Mm. It felt wrong. And I didn't feel as motivated. Yep. And I certainly didn't think it was more productive. Some people go, oh, it's more productive. No, because you're only focusing on yourself. It's one needs to think it's not just about you. It's actually about the company and the team.
Yep.
And the team will benefit and thrive for being with each other. But it's not just about the businesses either, as in your own company. It's about the entire ecosystem of a city. If everybody worked from home, then there's no requirement for so many things.
Why not? I mean,
you wouldn't have restaurants, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have bars, you wouldn't have cafes, you wouldn't have gyms, you wouldn't have anything. But also, there's a if you didn't need office buildings, then what about all of the people that participate in creating an office building, working in an office building? From the architects that design them to the engineers, to the planners, the contractors, the fabricators, yeah. the designers,
furniture,
the staff,
everything.
Imagine everything. And we're just touching, mm-hmm. scratching the surface, but there's so many component parts. A commercial, commercial offices and what it brings. Mm. Imagine that was taken away. Then we'd all be in big trouble. A city would be in big trouble. I mean, they said that TfL was running some substantial losses because people were not travelling on the system. And if people don't travel on the system, then they can't run a system. Mm. And then you won't have a transport system.
Or everyone else suffers so badly because prices have been hiked so badly, and then people can't afford it anyway.
So I think the thing is that we're all kind of joined at the hip with real estate in some stretch of the imagination. Whether you like property or you don't, it's all kind of still very, very relevant because it forms an ecosystem that we can't actually ignore. So I guess it's more a case of embracing it and enjoying it rather than just thinking, I just want to spend my time at home. I can't imagine what it must be like for people that come out of university. They're studying for something, and then they go, right, I'm ready to go into the working world. And imagine it was like, right, I'm going to work at home, not meet anybody, not learn anything from anybody. Mm-hmm. Young people
no
need...
No training, no mentorship, no
That's
nothing.
What I'm talking about. You're absolutely right. And it's very, very important. Mm. And it doesn't matter what kind of line of work that you're in.
Learning to socialise in the adult world, right? Not university, not school.
Absolutely.
I mean, just even that, the social skills to be able to go to work, work in a team, maybe go out for a drink, learn to
100%.
Socialise with other people that aren't your same age group.
Absolutely. You can't do that. You see, what I always say is that you cannot. I find that when I meet somebody on a Zoom call or a Teams call, whatever the platform that you you use these days, I call it a digital rendezvous. And it's almost a case of I've never met you. And what I mean is that I won't. I know that that person probably can't really appreciate what I look like. Right. They see me on screen, but if they saw me in the street, 9 times out of 10, they probably
maybe a second glance, but that's about it.
But what I'm saying is, it's not just the optics. It's the feeling and being in the presence of people matters. And when you want to forge relationships with people, I'm being a bit old school. Maybe I'm being a bit short sighted. I don't know. But this is just the way I feel. But I don't feel that you can really harness a relationship by just being. Having a digital encounter.
No, I agree.
Right. And I think that you have significant benefits from, breaking bread with somebody, having a drink. You feel like you've met somebody, you've hung out with somebody.
Yep.
There is a relation. You go up several levels in one's relationship, mm-hmm. just by doing that. And I think there's too much of a disconnect by just relying upon a digital encounter. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't work. And people, whatever line of work you're in, you buy into people because trust is very, very important. And you only can really get a sense for that if you get to know somebody. And you only really get to do that if you do it in person. And that just is from all walks of life. Yep. So mm-hmm. I think it just shouldn't be so kind of, short-sighted to think that this is, you know, the way I'd like to be. I'm just going to be work from home forever. I do think it's positive that more office workers are considering, you know, going into the office more frequently. I think it would be foolish to assume that people are going to be in every single day of the week. I don't think anyone would expect that be the case. I'd like to think it would be more often than not, and I like to think that they probably would get more out of it ultimately. But you know, agile working practices, companies are still trying to find their way with it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's a hard and fast, there's one size fits all with any business. Some companies are more liberal than others, and maybe it works for them.
Some companies need more collaboration than others, right?
That's
so
true.
Our business, for example, right, is so now, or yes, I need it yesterday, right? Because in the bridging space, I don't want, as sales director, if I need to speak to an underwriter on a case that's got to complete, I don't need to book a Zoom meeting in 4 hours' time because we're both at home, because they're maybe on two other Zoom meetings and there's Iris booked. I need to know now because I've got a broker calling me, I've got a lawyer
calling me,
I've got an accountant. I can't wait that time. I just like to be able to walk across from my desk to their desk, go, have you got 1 minute? Yes. Right, can we just chat, done.
See, you've just given a prime example of, you know, any kind of business would benefit from that encounter.
Yep.
It's an impulsive, I just need a quick chat, X, Y, and Z, job done. And also, it will, by doing so, it provokes further questioning, further ideas, yep, further conversations, and things will get done.
Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm. And like you said, if you needed to pull, Duncan in, for example, yep, for a quick chat, you can do that on impulse. Mm-hmm. You can't do that if you can't see them, or you have to book
outside,
an appointment.
Out of mind. I don't care what anyone says.
It's true.
Like,
it's true.
And on even just that conversation I've had with that underwriter, I go back, speak to the broker. Broker comes up with another question. I can go straight back. If I've had a Zoom call, and I've come out with a question,
yeah,
I might not get another Zoom call for God knows how long, or another call, or they might not answer Slack, or all the other tools that we've been given.
And also, it's actually interesting, you know, I was also thinking that with Zoom calls and Teams calls, they are actually quite formal.
They are.
And normal is British etiquette, there's almost etiquette on a Zoom call, right? For example, how long, you know, there's a lot of preamble and discussion, and you think, well, if I've arranged a call, it can't be a 10-second chat.
No.
Because you don't, for some reason, etiquette means that you've kind of got to like pad it out a little bit,
yep,
talk about, and it's like, no, I just, it just is. Or what other, you know, we've got this call, maybe we should use that time wisely and talk about other stuff, and it feels a little bit contrived and forced in some respects,
yep,
when really, like you just said, you just want to speak to that person in a very casual, serendipitous kind of exchange, yep, right? And then things will happen. And that's why you guys are successful at what you do, right? Because you've got that cohesion,
yep,
right? And you know, that's not a fluke, you know?
Multiple conversations all day.
All day.
The amount of times you're putting people in, talking, that it happens all day.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're
some pro office people here, which is good, because my next question number three is, can you invest in commercial real estate?
Well, yes, of course you can. Yeah, there's such a wide variety of different ways of investing, usually speaking, you have, you know, a person or company that wants to invest in commercial property and have the benefit of occupier income and things like that. You can do that, or you can invest in syndicates with lots of different entities as well. I know that's something that's similar that I think you guys do, where you do, you know, investing, is that right? Or
fractional ownership.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a whole kind of, you know, variety of ways of investing in property.
What are the differences between investing in commercial property and residential? What are the pros and cons? What are the, you know, would you go both? Well,
I think diversification is a good thing, and probably wouldn't only invest in one and not the other. But you know, commercial has its benefits, I suppose, because of the way that occupiers sign contracts, and normally they tend to sign If it's on a lease basis, they tend to sign a full repairing and insuring obligation, which means they're basically the occupier is fully responsible for the upkeep of the building throughout the tenancy. And when they leave, they have to obviously reinstate it and put it back almost to the way they found it. So there's a big responsibility on the tenant to do that, but that's a significant benefit to a landlord commercial property owner. And you have a little bit more consistent streams of income from that point of view, and it can probably generate more income than some of the residential properties, because residential tends to be ASTs between, you know, six to 12 months most of the time, and it's much more active management and things that go on with that. So you're dealing with kind of individuals in residential, but you're dealing with companies that sign leases in commercial. Mm-hmm. So they are materially very, very different.
What is the most unusual commercial real estate investment you've seen?
Goodness me, I've been involved in a few. I mean, one of the ones I've been quite proud of, about a year ago now, I worked on this most magnificent property for my client. It was a former courthouse in Clerkenwell. It was called Old Sessions House. It's about 250-year-old island site, quite magnificent, ornate building. And my clients, Satilla, they're a Swedish private family who diversify in real estate and buy some really glamorous buildings around the world. But this particular one took them nearly 5 years to restore and renovate. Yeah. And it was such a unique building because of it had grade two star listed status. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very important building in the borough of Islington in Clerkenwell. You have to be really sympathetic to architecture like that, because you want to make sure that you preserve it and you can celebrate it and you can do all the right things to it. And this particular client had such mm-hmm. a passion for the project, and I did as well. We just absolutely loved every part of it, and it took many, many years to get to bring it into a condition. And what we ended up delivering was an amazing not just an office building, but also the client created this magnificent, almost like a secret restaurant in the old judge's dining room, which is magnificent. It's called the Sessions Arts
Club.
I've been
trying to go there for about a year now.
It's very, very difficult to get a table there, but it's just the most beautiful atmospheric setting. I would highly recommend it. The food is absolutely fantastic.
I think you have to book at 7 a.m. Yeah. 3 months in advance of the time you want to go.
Oh, it's incredible. But this building was so beautiful, and it had these amazing old former courtrooms. Amazing. And things like that. So I can only imagine the history, who must have passed through those doors, or the trials that would have been set there. You know, I think the last hanging in England was in Clerkenwell Green outside, and it was probably as a consequence of a conviction from the building. It's really quite historic and a very important property, for the location.
I'll get up 7 a.m. tomorrow. Nick, we can go.
All right, let's do it.
So moving on to question number four.
Yeah, sure.
Can you get a mortgage for commercial property?
Oh, you absolutely, of course you can. You certainly can. It's slightly different to, you know, somebody, you know, wanting a mortgage for a house. It's slightly more stricter underwriting credentials and analysing and valuations that need to be done. So you can, basically.
Is that something, as a commercial real estate agent, you would advise on? Or is it like they would work with a broker and you guys as well?
Well, I suppose we can participate in some generalistic advice, but we don't advise on commercial lending and things like that. But obviously, by the nature of what we do obviously collaborate with mm-hmm. our clients in that regard. So, yes.
And are there any government schemes to help people buy commercial property? Offices and stuff.
I'm not entirely sure. I don't think that there is, not quite in the same way that perhaps is with residential help to buy schemes and things mm-hmm. like that. But with commercial, not as much, I would say. There are, some buildings, not necessarily in purchase, but there are some more affordable workspace zones or property or parts of property that are dedicated for helping, you know, SME businesses and smaller mm-hmm. enterprises, with spaces effectively and flexible occupations and more affordable rents. But there aren't that many of those necessarily.
One benefit, I suppose, is that with commercial real estate, you can own it in your pension. So whereas residential, you can't.
Yes.
So that has got some benefits.
That's very true.
Can you go into that a little bit further? A little bit of an explanation?
Not really, if I'm honest. Yeah. Not the finer details.
Well, that's
throw ideas around.
No, that is true. And I suppose, you know, like I said, the material difference between, you know, a commercial office investment and residential investment, you know, I suppose with a commercial investment, you do have the benefit of longer term income potentially, and income that is hopefully underwritten responsible by companies that sign these leases. Whereas, you know, in residential terms, yeah, you know, they're much shorter tenancies, and you're dealing with individuals, and there's different legislation towards that. But, you know, commercial property will give you longer term income, mm-hmm, ultimately, a little bit more secure, one might say.
And final question for today. Question number five. How did you get into commercial real estate? If you can cast your mind back.
Yes, no. So I got into commercial property. I literally was a school leaver, I wasn't the cleverest kid in school, and family didn't have too much money to send me to university. And my dad said to me, do you want to, you know, pull pints in a pub and have a big student loan, or, you know, do you want to kind of go straight into work? And I was very, very keen to, you know, I was motivated by money and get, you know, because didn't have much. And I literally just jumped in, had a family friend who told me to go and see a lovely man who still works in a property called Richard Susskind, who I owe a lot to. He was like my mentor. He gave me a chance, went to go and see him when I was literally the day after I left school. And he said, you know, do you want to come in and, you know, on Monday? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, just come and start. Start what? and he said, oh, you know, the beginning. I said, okay. And I stayed there for 10 years. So I learned an awful lot there. I had an amazing time. Met my business partners there as well, it was an amazing ride. And then set up my own commercial agency in 2010 called Hatton Real Estate, that was literally in the eye of the storm from the back end of the financial crisis in 2010. And I think timing is everything in life. So mm-hmm, I think we hit that wave at the right time, and had the business for 5.5 years, and successfully sold the business to Colliers International, had a 5-year contract and stint with them, which had a great time. They're really, really fabulous people. It's a great business. And then from there, we set up Compton, which is my current business, mm-hmm, in April of 2001. So we're literally coming up to our second anniversary within the next 48 hours.
Ah,
so we're thank you very much. Very excited.
And I guess, how have you seen the market change? How has the market changed in the last 5 years? We briefly touched, I guess that's now COVID, coming into COVID and everything like that. But let's go before.
Yeah.
You were saying how Clerkenwell, Farringdon all used to be warehouses. How has what's that kind of timeline?
Goodness me. Well, it's quite a broad topic. How's the market? Well, you say how's the market changed in the past 5 years, or how's the
commercial real estate market?
Commercial real estate market.
Stick with London.
Yeah. So, well, it's changed an awful lot. Certainly from what we were talking about, more agile working practices and people working from home has affected, you know, commercial real estate in certain ways, and certain companies don't know how much space that they need to take anymore. And, you know, you might have a company that, you know, has got 100 people that work for the company, but they might say, well, we're not going to have 100% of people being at any one time, so maybe we don't need quite as much space. But
are people taking less space in hot desking?
Some of them are. But the danger, I think, that all of them are considering is, well, if we take too little space, that actually could be more harmful than taking slightly too much space. And also, you want to kind of back yourself thinking, well, if you're an aspiring company, you want to grow, you know, then you would certainly want to think, I've got a big enough boat. So there can be a danger of taking too little. But obviously, if you've got a flexible, you know, lease arrangement, then you can obviously exit. But listen, moving is disruptive and expensive. Mm-hmm. So you kind of want to do it not as frequently, if you can help it.
And are people thinking a lot more about the type and quality of space because they want to attract people back into the office more?
You're bang on with that. I mean, you know, as we were just talking about, you know, we were talking about how we felt quite passionately about working in the office.
If any of you didn't.
No, we weren't particularly subtle. But I think that I think what plays a key role in that is the environment. Yep. You know, because ultimately speaking, you know, if you're going to go to the trouble of going somewhere, you want it to be a nice place to work, nice place to hang out and enjoy for your own, you know, for your own well-being. Why would you not want to be in a nice place? Yep. Mm-hmm. And that resonates with a lot of companies, a lot of businesses, because
the whitewashed clinical walls of days gone by.
Definitely. You know, and you need to, but people need to be inspired, you know, and I think that's really important. It doesn't matter what line of work you're in. You know, you still have a need to be inspired if you're a solicitor or whether you work in advertising. You know, you still need that. Yep. So I think that having an environment that is attractive and desirable enough, that helps a company with their kind of growth potential. They want to attract, as you said, new talent, right? But also staff retention. Let's not forget that. It's not just about attracting. You want people to, you know, somebody to think, well, I love coming here. I mean, I get so much out of it, right? From a productivity-wise, but also from, you know, a well-being perspective.
Social engagement a lot.
No, but that's important. And companies, a lot of, you know, forward-thinking companies, they recognise that. That's why, you know, the landlords also do, because they want to provide property now that's not just like, here's an office, that's it. They're trying to provide, you know, additional amenity and facilities beyond the borders of a tenant's demise, so they can enjoy, you know, communal roof terrace spaces. They can enjoy some gym facilities. They can enjoy, you know, social zones, cafes. You know, they want to enjoy, you know, wellness centres. You know, all that kind of stuff. Landlords are trying to incorporate into their development to try to make their properties appear more attractive, effectively.
We've been to our office and we've done the same thing. Oh, we're out of central London, but we had to find a way to attract talent to an area outside of London.
That's right.
You know, probably slightly within commuter belt, but what's going to attract people to come to us, stay to us and travel that little bit further maybe to come and work with us and for us and stay for a long time? Well, hopefully the office environment that we've created and the building.
It absolutely is. And I've been to your office. And I think it's a beautiful place, actually. And it's a really wonderful environment. But to your point, it's not just about if somebody comes to work for TAB, it's like, there's your desk. See you later. Anything but, right? No. I'm pretty sure. And the fact that you've got so many different zones that people can literally just hang out in. In fact, you probably encourage, you know, you can encourage it, or you're like, you know what, let's get out of here and let's go and hang out over here, because, you know, the environment kind of, you know, attracts you to do that, you know.
Keeps you on your toes, you can never find Nick.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, if you're providing, we provide breakfast, we provide lunch for staff, and the idea is that you sit in a clubhouse community area where you're all eating and talking away from your desk. You have that break, but also hopefully there's a financial benefit. I mean, you're having to go out and buy lunch every single day.
That's great that you guys do that. Sort of
look, my final question, because we're going to have to wrap this up soon, is what's the most creative thing, or the creative kind of idea that offices of companies you've seen come up with since this to kind of attract people, would you say? You've gone, wow, that's clever.
Goodness me.
if you can point it down spot. To one.
The most creative thing.
Take notes, Nick, because we want to do this.
Well, I suppose the most creative thing, I would probably say, providing, I don't know whether it's necessarily overly creative, but I think people value space that is a more of a social zone, and people value outside space. I mean, outside space wins prizes from both a landlord and tenant perspective. Having outside spaces, you know, roof gardens, things like that, that's pretty awesome. And I know that, I mean, you know, what I found that particularly creative was it's a client of mine, Derwent London, built a building by Old Street Roundabout. Was a building called White Collar Factory, and at the top of the building they put a running track. Cool. So an actual running track that kind of meanders its way around the perimeter at the top of the building, and basically, you know, occupiers can literally at lunchtime brilliant. In the morning, you can actually do laps around the building, but amazing at the top views. Of the building, unrivaled views of the entire, you know, entire London. It's
on just skyline.
Unbelievable. Wow. So that is one of the more unique things that I've seen, which is pretty special. And then, you know, that building, this is completely different, but you know that building I just mentioned earlier. Old Sessions House, which is a magnificent building. They've got this beautiful roof garden, but they've also got an infinity swimming pool up there. Absolutely sensational.
Right, we're going back to the office and
so, right. So that's
start digging.
So all Duncan, these we want an infinity pool.
Yeah, that's sorry, Dunks.
It's not much to ask, but you know, we are trying to attract talent.
Great. Well, on that note, I'm sure Dunk will be delighted to know that he's now got to spend some money on an infinity pool. But thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks
today.
For having
it's been
me.
Really, really fun.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Great stuff.
Thanks to all of our listeners. I hope you enjoyed it and looking forward to seeing you next time. Bye.